You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Vohner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. Nice to have you join us this Sunday evening. My guest this week is NPR author and journalist Steve Drummond. His new book is The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Steve, welcome.
Hi, Al. Thank you. Good to be here.
Hey, by the way, corruption in politics? Nah, can't be. Say it's not so, Steve.
Well, some things never change.
Well, the first and foremost, you and I talked a little bit before broadcast, and I mentioned how I love history personally, but the man in question here, Harry Truman, who went on at this point, he was not president yet, but was certainly working, I guess, toward that goal. I've always heard that of, even to this very day, especially somebody who follows history, who's a history buff, will tell you that Harry Truman was true blue, was a man very disciplined, was a man who had a conscience about him, how he approached things. What I'm trying to say is in preparing for the book, The Watchdog, did you come away with the same sense that, you know, nobody's perfect, but this guy had the United States and the citizens of this country's best interest at heart?
I did, and it's what makes Truman a lot of fun to write about. Or, you know, it's actually kind of an inspiring story. You have this guy who had been in public service by this time for 15 years and kind of had steadfastly refused to get rich off of it, as a lot of people did. And one of the things that people responded to during World War II to the Truman Committee and to Truman himself was this feeling that here was a public servant who was kind of looking out for their interests. Many of them had sons overseas fighting in combat, and they felt like Truman was trying to make sure, you know, they got the best equipment, the best uniforms, the best rifles. And it was a great pleasure to me over several years reading these documents and going through and kind of getting to know Truman a bit.
Steve, in the book itself, The Watchdog, I mean, right off the bat, an apropos title, as you just talked about, he was looking after the taxpayers. He was making sure that what was needed, especially as, we embroil ourselves in war. But was it at that particular time when he was sitting as chairman of this committee in terms of corruption, were there more than one thing that he had his eye on, or was it just, you know, making sure that during wartime, that we have enough resources for our military men and women, that the home front was safe? Were there other issues, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, that were very important to him at this particular moment?
Yeah, there were several goals. As you point out, the government was embarking on its largest spending program in its history at that time. So, yeah, just the basic thing of making sure the taxpayers' money was being well spent. But Truman had several other goals here, too, one of which was small businesses. Truman came from the Midwest. He grew up far from the giant corporations of the East and giant banks. He was suspicious of them. And throughout the war, Truman was adamant that if all this government money was going to be spent, that some of it go to small businesses. Like, you know, he himself had been a small businessman. He had great sympathy for, you know, what he called the little guy. And that was a big focus of his committee as well, was trying to make sure that all the big government contracts would not go to just a few large corporations.
Yeah, and the thing, my family was, the reason I bring it up is because part of my background was a family in the haberdashery business, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that his line of work?
It was, and you know, people don't know Truman's backstory today as well as they once did when he was president or when he was alive, but yeah, after coming back from combat service in World War I, Truman had made a good friend in the Army, a guy named Eddie Jacobson, and they decided to go to business together in Kansas City, and they opened a haberdashery, a men's furnishings store, sold shirts and all kinds of things. And Truman made a go of it for several years, and by the early 1920s, the economy had turned south, and the business you know, went belly up, and that's when he left to become a farmer. So there were it's a key part of his story and important to his makeup in his later public service.
Well, that's why I bring it up, and I'm glad that you put an additional emphasis on that, is the fact that but by today's standards, and I'm not saying that everybody runs for office has a net worth of $10 or $20 million, but it takes big money, certainly, to build an organization if you are going to be in politics. But this is a guy, I guess the right term would be humble and a true he came from nothing, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, and learned from the bottom up. So he had that empathy, correct me if I'm wrong, for average people, for people who had to go out and work from early morning to late in the afternoon or evenings just to put bread and butter on their table, right?
Yeah. For several years, after his family fortunes had trouble, Truman spent several years as a farmer, just like every other farmer, getting up before the sun came up, working hard, and going to bed late. And so when he became a politician, he really was able to speak the language of these people in the way that many other folks couldn't. And, in the period I write about during World War II, this served Truman well. Several times early in the committee's existence, he went on the radio and he said, "Hey, we need your help, America. If something's going on down at the factory, you see something wrong at the shipyard you work in, let us know." And people did. Hundreds and eventually thousands of times, people picked up a pen or pencil and, sat down, "Dear Senator Truman, Washington, D.C., and they told him what was going wrong. And some of these letters led to some of the committee's biggest investigations.
Steve, with these committee assignments, you don't always get to pick and choose. Obviously, you have to have support of your not only of your constituents, but certainly your fellow lawmakers. So I get the sense that his own, other senators, congresspeople, people in law, in the government, in Washington specifically during that period, had recognized a certain purity, a certain talent, and an honesty, and someone that could get the job done. Was he respected by his peers?
He was. Initially, Truman had a rough start in the Senate. He had been he was very closely linked to the Kansas City political machine, a guy named Tom Pendergast. It was kind of the only way you could, achieve public office in certain places at that time. But when he came to Washington, Truman was kind of written off as the senator from Pendergast, he was called. But over time, people kind of realized here was a senator who sat quietly, who learned, who read his history. He was a very loyal soldier for Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. And after a few years, this had slowly served him well in the Senate. He wasn't a grandstander. He didn't seek headlines. He kind of followed the party's goal. And when he began the committee, that became an important factor. He gathered around him several like-minded senators, serious, hardworking public service, not the flashiest guys in the Senate. And it became a key factor in building the, kind of bipartisan consensus that the Truman Committee became known for.
Was he at that time, was he eyeballing the presidency, or was that not even on the radar screen?
I would say not at all. It was 2 years into the committee. Once Truman had built this national reputation, with these investigations that were saving the public money, saving lives on the battlefield, Truman was becoming a national figure. He had gone, in a couple of years from being a virtually unknown outside the state of Missouri to being kind of a national figure. In late 1943, as Franklin Roosevelt was thinking about a fourth term, the leaders in the Democratic Party were really looking at who would be the vice president. Roosevelt, unknown to most of the country, but to the party leaders, Roosevelt was very ill. It was widely believed that he would not survive a fourth term, and so the question of who would be his vice president was becoming even more important. Once the idea came up, it was mentioned to Truman in 1943, and then gradually all the time, Truman said no. He didn't want to be vice president. He didn't want the job. He thought it was a ceremonial job that, and basically, as he put it, where you sit around waiting for a funeral. He said no. He pretty much said no right up until the Chicago Convention in August 1944, when Franklin Roosevelt pretty much got on the phone and told him to take the job.
I got to say, Steve, I chuckle there because I think especially more so back then than today, basically that's what it was. I mean, he wasn't the yeah. leader. He wasn't recognized for much more than, like you said, just kind of sitting back and waiting for
right.
the president to pass on so that he could move up the ladder. I do want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is NPR author and journalist Steve Drummond. His new book is The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Steve, you know, the emphasis on, much of the emphasis is on making sure that, you know, no waste or mm-hmm. you know, looking into wasteful habits, organizations, companies even, who were trying to take advantage of government, perhaps government, I'm assuming mostly government contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So was his heart looking after our front line? And what I mean by that is the soldiers, people who had to be on the front line, as well as, and because you said it earlier, as well as the taxpayers. I mean, was it always the
right.
the average American that was his focus during these, you know, during these investigations?
Very much so. And Truman, as you say, he had served in combat in World War I. He had been in the Army. He knew how things work, and it really helped in his dealings with the committee. But as you say, he was always focused on, you know, making sure that the soldiers and sailors on the front lines were being well served back, you know, behind the lines and back home. I'll give you one good example is famously those landing boats that you see in the movies often that took the soldiers from a ship offshore, a mile or two offshore, and getting them to the beach. This was a big question during World War II. How could you take thousands of men and have them climb down off a ship and get them on shore? There was no such thing as these landing boats. And so the Navy had invented its own model of landing boat. It turned out, and then there was a larger landing boat needed to take a tank ashore, a 30-ton tank. This was kind of a really complicated question, this notion of offshore landings. There was a New Orleans boat builder, Andrew Higgins, who had designed a much more efficient, safer landing boat. And somehow he couldn't get through to the Navy. The military officials had their own design. They favored it. Finally, Higgins reached out to Truman for help. Hey, you know, what should we do here? Truman had a simple idea. He said to the Navy, take this guy's boat and take your boat, and let's put them a test. Put a tank on each one, sail them several miles, and land it on the shore. This happened in Norfolk, Virginia in 1943, and it turned out Higgins' boat delivered its tank to the shore and then came back to circle around the Navy's design, which was foundering in the choppy waters, and never did make it to shore. The Navy was forced to acknowledge that its own design was a dangerous design and adopted Higgins's design. General Dwight Eisenhower often said that these Higgins boats, as they were called, were a major factor in the D-Day invasion. Kept a lot of sailors from drowning offshore before they ever reached the beach. Soldiers, I should say.
Yeah, and just to clarify, as Steve is talking about, anybody who's watched the World War II movie, you know, those boats, as he said, transporting equipment and men, where the front would open up and they would have access
yeah.
to the beachfront. Otherwise, God knows how many people would have been drowned before they even got to the beach. So here's a guy who most people even to this day would look back and say, you know, it wasn't tall, handsome, dynamic in any way, but boy, did he have, you know, what I'm saying, Steve, is this came down to just basic common sense, and I always believe that at the end of the day, that always prevails. Was that him specifically? Was he just basically about, hey, let's cut through all the crap, let's focus yep. on what has to be done here, and look at A and then look at B, and then we'll decide. It seems so simplistic, but by today's standards, Steve, I don't even know if that would even fly. So I get the sense that he was a no-nonsense, straightforward, common-sense kind of leader.
Oh, very, very much so. Truman, as you probably know, was the last president we had who did not go to college. He had work. He had, you know, he had made his own way every stage in his life, and that that, you know, gave him a certain strength. As you say, he wasn't a fan. You know, he had tough shoes to fill. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was a charismatic world leader. He had grown up wealthy and affluent, and sort of felt comfortable in that world. Truman, not at all. He wasn't a great public speaker. And frankly, early on in this period in his time, he was frankly a pretty bad public speaker. But as he got used to it, he grew into the role. And that's part of what I'm writing, the story I'm writing in this book, is watching Truman grow into the job of becoming a national leader and sort of preparing him for the challenges he would face as president.
By today's standards, somebody labeled a watchdog, two things. Some people are going to react in two different ways. One, that's a good thing. Someone's keeping an eye on something for somebody. Or this is just somebody sticking their nose where it doesn't belong in hopes of, in hopes of feathering their own cap. So among his, again, I go back to his peers. Right. And you know how large egos are, especially in government. Somebody happens to have a great idea. Everybody's tussling to take a piece of the action, get on board I threw some ideas into all of this. Was he during this period among his peers, especially in the Congress, did they listen to him? Did they respect him? And did they give him the latitude necessary to pursue investigations and uncover corruption?
I would say not at first. When Truman proposed the idea of this committee in early 1941, not everybody was crazy about the idea, especially Franklin Roosevelt. Here was a young, unknown senator from his own party proposing to investigate the administration's handling of the defense buildup. Franklin Roosevelt thought that was not a great idea at all, and neither did leaders in the Democratic Party. But if it soon became clear that if a Democrat didn't do this investigation, then Republicans would. They were ready to go. They were happy to take it on. And so Truman was allowed to create this committee as a bit of a steam valve. They gave him a very small appropriation, $15,000, and said, okay, you can have your committee. It was Truman who kind of turned it into earned the respect and earned the ability to keep going. His first report, right when he started the committee, the first report was about army camps and waste and corruption in army camps. It quickly became clear that the government had wasted about $100 million building army camps around the country. This made national headlines around the when Truman put out his first report, and there that sort of gave him the green light to keep going.
With that said, and I keep thinking, I use today as a barometer, I'm thinking, If this were a world war we were engaged in right now, our top generals, our top military leaders, and yourself, being a historian and an author, again, big egos. And I'm thinking, here's a guy who's delving into every facet of the Air Force, the Navy, the Army, the Marines, to find out where corruption with good intent, good intent, making sure that the soldiers, those on the front lines, have everything they need to win this war. As you said, I'm thinking people are looking at this, this Midwestern guy and thinking, what business does he have, delving into my affairs? I graduated from West Point. I'm a general, or I'm a leader of men. So what I'm saying is, was the military itself, forget the peers, forget the Congress, forget President Roosevelt for the time being, military leaders who had Roosevelt's ear, did they find him to be more of a nuisance, or were they on board with what he was trying to uncover?
That's a great question. As you know, nobody likes a critic, and here was a senator coming in telling the military they were doing things wrong. They were wasting money. The many high leaders in the government didn't like that at all. And then conveniently, they had a powerful argument against such a committee. Basically, after Pearl Harbor, after December 7th, 1941, the military reached out to Roosevelt, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, and said, hey, we should stop this committee. A couple of arguments. There is a war on. We need to win the war as quickly as possible. We don't have time to spend all this time gathering documents and going up on Capitol Hill to testify. There's a war on. The other common complaint they made was, well, this guy, here's this guy pinching pennies, looking for every dollar that we can save. There's no time for that. We're in a hurry. We're in a rush. Truman made the opposite argument. Once war had broken out, he said, listen, this becomes even more important that we investigate. If waste and inefficiency is holding up, keeping airplanes and tanks, trucks from getting to the front lines, we can help out here. Roosevelt ended up agreeing with Truman. The Truman Committee was allowed to continue its work. And no question that was to the benefit of the country, to the soldiers and sailors in the field, and to the taxpayers at home.
That leads me to believe then that when, you know, as you talked about today, I'm thinking $15,000. I mean, basically, you can have one fundraiser, and that money is out the window. So did that help? Because I'm sure initially people are thinking, well, you know, this guy's an upstart. We'll keep the appropriations away from him. Obviously, he needed more revenue to as the committee grew and as they started doing more investigations. Did he have a hard time getting money? Or, as you said, once the president got on board and the party started recognizing that, look, you know, either we join him or we watch the Republicans take their, you know, take their turn and take pot shots at this thing. So was money ever a major concern, appropriating enough money to continue the investigations?
It was. That $15,000, just to give you a sense of how much money that was back then, Truman was trying to hire a whole staff and stenographers and investigators, lawyers, and he needed a chief counsel. He hired a top lawyer from New York City and agreed to pay him $9,000 a year. That was a decent money. Truman himself only made $10,000 a year as a senator. So that tells you, you know, one lawyer used up half the committee's money.
Yeah.
He figured out a way to park some of the other investigators on the payrolls of cabinet agencies. But that $15,000 appropriation didn't last very long. And every few months throughout the war, Truman would have to go back to the Senate and ask for additional funds. While generally his requests were granted, they were almost always just a little bit at a time. The next time he got $25,000, which is enough to keep going for a few months. And this would periodically happen during the war. Having said that, once Truman was on the front pages with investigations, $100 million wasted in army camps, for example, it became a lot harder to say no to him. And then, as Truman would say later during life, though, throughout the war, the Truman Committee expended less than $1 million of public funds and, by all agreements, saved the country billions of dollars. So it ended up being a pretty good investment for the American taxpayer.
You know, I have read I've read biographies about him in the past, and as I said, he does not stand out even to this day. Unfortunately, I mean, he doesn't stand in the same stature as a FDR or an Abe Lincoln. But boy, did we ever have a guy who had had our backs?
With little, in
terms of, you know, self making money for himself, making a name for himself. If that came, all well and good, but that was certainly not his intent. During these investigations, was there one key focus for him? I mean, was there a particular industry that he was most intent on uncovering? Was there part of what part of the military was his main focus? Was there any one thing that really took up most of his time?
It shifted throughout the war, depending on the changing circumstances. But one of the key factor areas that the Truman Committee looked into was aviation. This was a huge question. At the beginning of the war, one of the Truman Committee's early reports made clear that early in the war, while the United States had done a pretty good job of making airplanes and making bombers, big four-engine bombers, the fighter planes that U.S. pilots were flying, it soon became clear, were not as good as the planes being flown by Japanese or German pilots. The Truman Committee pointed this out. The military wasn't happy about it, but it was really no way to sugarcoat it. And there were newer, modern, better planes on the drawing boards, and the Truman Committee several times stepped in to argue, hey, you need to speed this up. You need to you need to let these older planes go and really invest in the new planes. Eventually, the Army Air Forces, as it was called then, would get its act together. But early in the war, Truman was nudging them constantly. So that's just one example of the kind of focuses that that the committee was taking.
Had he not had any military, I mean, you were, I mean, I don't know if you had military background. I didn't. Family members.
I do
had.
Not.
So if I'm sitting in Truman's shoes, I'm thinking, I don't know diddly about Air Force, military, naval, you know, as you talked about, you know, the boats taking him right to the shore, all the things that really made a difference. So what I'm saying is, had he not had some military background, might this have been more of a challenge for him identifying, you know, where there was waste or where we could gain a foothold and, you know, and speed this thing up?
I think so. It really, you know, serving in the military, Truman had an understanding of kind of the military mindset, how these people thought and worked, and he had been an officer, so he had got to know many of the people who were, you know, officers during World War I were now the leaders. So during World War II, 20 years later, they had become generals and admirals. He had a firsthand knowledge of many of these people, and it really helped him along. But he also knew kind of their mindset. Truman said later in life, you know, no military man cares a bit about money. All they care about is how to spend it, and they don't care whether they're getting their money's worth. There was such a race to get the best planes, the best tanks, the best ships. The problem was sometimes the agencies of the military were fighting against each other. There was a shortage of steel and of rubber, for example. The Navy, oh, we need this for our ships. The Air Forces, we need this for our planes. The Army, we need steel for tanks. Always there was this competition. A lot of what Truman did was kind of trying to play referee between these agencies and trying to figure out where would the resources go where they were most needed.
Well, I'll tell you, Steve, from reading your book, which reinforced all of that into what I know of this man, he certainly accomplished, I think, something that most people would not have been able to do then. And it was a combination of his his understanding of issues and his common sense approach, but also I think the humble beginnings, having to be a bootstrapper himself, learning, mm-hmm. you know, waste is not going to get us where we have to go. And then also the lives of men and women who served on the front line. There was so much going on. In fact, I got to throw this in because as you were talking, I keep thinking about, and I'm sure you're aware of it too, the I guess today would be called an iconic sitcom, All in the Family. Well, the opening theme song included mm-hmm. a man like Harry. We need a guy like Harry Truman again. So, I mean, you know, long after his death, and here you are, you know, writing in the year 2023, writing a book about a guy that most people today, if you talk to anybody, most people wouldn't even say, Harry who? But he was really somebody that we can look up to and really respect and wish that we had more people like him serving the public, in government, because he did so much for the average man or woman. Steve, with a few moments that we have left, I know the book is widely available, but if people want to get more information, maybe pose questions to you personally or just get a sense of, you know, what went into this book and like I said, just questions in general, can they reach out to you?
Sure can. I'm on Twitter, at sdrubin at NPR. But the easiest way is I have a website, stevedrubinbooks.com. There's a form you can fill out. And since the book came out, again, it's stevedrubinbooks.com. Since the book came out, I'm hearing people all over the country, the relatives of some of the people who served on the Truman Committee, just people who are kind of history nuts. Hey, what about this? It's really, really fun, especially for me as a first-time author. It's been really fun hearing from people and answering their questions. It's I'm really enjoying it. Some people are reaching out to say, hey, can I get the book on audio? Yes, you can find it there on my website, stevedrubinbooks.com. Can I get it on my Kindle? Anyway, it's been really, really a pleasure engaging with people in person at sometimes on the radio, but also via email.
And you know, Steve, I'm so glad that you said that, because again, as a, you know, I'm a history buff, but you know, you mentioned the name Truman, especially to a younger generation, and I'm not blaming them. I mean, they weren't privy to that.
Sure.
But once again, it reinforces the fact that you know, we can knock this country from Monday to Sunday, but the fact of the matter is, there are many good people, you know, who serve the public on a daily basis and have the best interest at heart. And this story, for me personally, not only was it enlightening in terms of history, but it brought once again to light the part of Truman, the heart of Truman, and that's always most important. So I'm glad to hear that people are asking to learn more about him, or just nice to hear more about him, because I think he was an underdog, and you know, he's getting his due now. So kudos to you on that. Again, I want to thank my guest this week, Steve Drummond, journalist and author, and the new book is The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. And boy, did it do that, for certain. And any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments or questions to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you.